Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
The world is absolutely ready for a climate change curator. And I believe I'm the first, but I'm definitely not the last. So there's several of us now around the world. Museums are one of the most trusted institutions amongst the public. I've been working as a limnologist for the last 15 or so years, which is someone who studies lakes. I'm a professional scientist. I've been looking at how climate change impacts lakes around the world and how they also feed back with climate change through greenhouse gas emissions. It's part of understanding the world. I mean, a lot of it is still learning as we're undertaking this global experiment of climate change and seeing what the planet's doing in response. As a person who studies lakes, it's been really interesting having my first curatorial collections item being sediments from Crawford Lake. This is a replica of a sediment core from Crawford Lake. If you can imagine a metal tube that's full of dry ice and someone's out on the top of a lake and they put this out into the water and they sink it to the bottom, into the mud at the bottom of the lake, all of that mud will freeze to the core, and as you pull it up and bring it to the surface, you can imagine this was the water at the bottom of the lake. This is the surface sediments or mud at the bottom. And then each of these white lines that you can see is one summer going back in history. And as you get deeper, you're going further and further back in history. All lakes have that feature where as you go deeper in the sediments, they go further back in history. But this core replica is from a very special lake called Crawford Lake, just close to Milton, Ontario. It has these summer white lines that is called varving. And that's a really unique feature of this lake. It's because of the chemistry, because of the way the lake is shaped that it does this. That's why this lake has actually been selected in the last year as the candidate golden spike of the Anthropocene epoch. So this would be defined as an epoch supplanting the Holocene epoch, which is the last 12 or so thousand years we are currently in, which would be now a new geological period defined by humanity's impact on the planet. So, you know, how does climate change impact lakes? And how does that change the way that they emit greenhouse gas emissions? And then those greenhouse gas emissions change climate change again. So this is where we talk about, for instance, climate tipping points around the planet, and lakes can play a really important role in that. Recently, an international group of experts has actually voted down the decision to create a new Anthropocene epoch.
The concept of the Anthropocene is important. We get a response as scientists to the thick, meaty, data-rich report we submitted as a proposal. Of course, I'm disappointed that the committee voted no. I haven't heard anything formally back. Everything I've seen so far has been in the media, initially through the New York Times, because almost everyone I've seen who admits to have voted no talks about us being in the Anthropocene.
From the 1290s to 1490s, we have two villages that were Attawandaron or Pre-Wendat villages, and they were farming corn and sunflowers, and there were probably several hundred people that lived by the lake around that time. After that, from around 1500 to the mid to late 1800s, we have a dark period where there was not any constant settlement, it seemed, around the lake, and this is also consistent with the Little Ice Age. Incidentally, the Little Ice Age was a period that during this period where the planet got somewhat cooler, so the northern hemisphere got about 0.8 degrees Celsius cooler, and there's a few little cool dips in there. There's some studies that have shown that the diseases that Europeans brought, especially smallpox, may have actually played a role in starting the Little Ice Age, in the fact that it led to a loss of 90% of indigenous lives in North and South America, and that led to a massive reforestation of the two continents. And it's believed that those forests may have drawn down as much carbon dioxide to actually create a global cooling during this period. So the Little Ice Age is a really interesting place to actually talk about the relationship between human health and planetary health and how that impacts societies around the world and the climate around the world. In the late 1800s, we have the Crawford family moving from England to Ontario, and they purchased the lake, so that's why it's called Crawford Lake today. And they took down a lot of trees all around the lake and built a sawmill, and that changed the chemistry of the lake in a significant way, where we can see a color shift, that impact of deforestation and construction around the lake. Moving forward around 1930s, we can see a very bright line that's associated with the Dust Bowl, especially in Midwestern North America. So you have a lot of sort of regional continental climatic change around that time. In the 1950s, we see an increase in fly ash that's likely associated with Hamilton industry. So that's a byproduct of the burning of fossil fuels. And we also see plutonium increasing, which is a byproduct of testing of nuclear weapons around the world. So we can see these two really important markers of the Anthropocene epoch in what's called the Great Acceleration after World War II. So that's when really things around the world started changing dramatically. And then moving forward, people have been looking at different impacts. For instance, even there's an algae bloom in the 1970s, which was really major in the lake, which is apparently kind of mysterious. People aren't sure why that happened in that year. And there's impacts of even the building of the visitor center around the lake. So there's a lot of history that's global and local that the lake speaks to. One of the things that I think is the most powerful about working with this core and the sediments from Crawford Lake and the story it tells is that, to me, it really changes how we talk about human impact on the planet. People often focus on nuclear weapons testings, and there's these pictures of mushroom clouds, and we think about all of the dark aspects of what people are capable of and what people have done. When we look at the history of any given lake, we don't look at the rise of plutonium with weapons testing. Since we do have this record everywhere on the planet, we do look for it, but we look for the drop, which is that testing's banned treaty. And I think it's interesting, what, again, I really love for talking about this lake is that we have a history that's not biased in any way. It's not an evil human story to me. It's recognizing that the planet is always listening, the lake is always listening. It's kind of a mirror to what we're doing, but it gives us a lot of insights in terms of how we should live. And for me, the biggest takeaway from that is moving away from this idea that our goal should be to have no impact on the planet. I think it's kind of an assumption for a lot of people that either we have an impact and it's bad and we're making things worse, or we create a national park or some kind of place that's cordoned off and we build a wall, we don't let people go there, and that's going to be the best case scenario if people don't go there. I think that's a fabrication, that's kind of an illusion. You know, there's always going to be some impact, there's always going to be climate impacts on areas now, even if we close them off. Really thinking then about, well, if we're always having an impact, we should think about how to flip it from a negative impact to a positive one. And what are the ways that we can live where we're actually interacting positively with the environment instead of negatively?
The science is good, and all of the science says that we need to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels as soon as possible, and not feel frustrated by, it's like when you go on a diet, not feel frustrated that the first few times you skip dessert that you don't look like a supermodel. It's not going to make rapid change. It will take a while for it to become felt because there's a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere already. But anyone who cares beyond their own generation, if they have children or grandchildren, or if they care just generally about the planet into the future, must realize that these are steps that we have to take. And that line on the time scale that the Subcommission on Quaternary Stratigraphy is in charge of, that really is a small, small item compared to the big message of the science that the Anthropocene Working Group did for 15 years and came up with all of those compelling data that urge us to take action.
It's interesting, as a limnologist, as someone who studies lakes, I do think that there's an argument to be made in terms of understanding how quickly
our ecosystems can return to prior conditions if you stop stressing them, if you stop pounding them or impacting them in these different kinds of ways with nutrients and hydrological changes. If we're going to say, no, we are not in the Anthropocene epoch, we can start thinking about, you know, actually accepting that we can revert to the Holocene conditions that have been around for the last 12,000 or so years. And we can bring the Earth systems back to that place if we really embrace the right conservation ethics. And certainly there are a lot of things that are going to go back. If we stop adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, we can potentially bring the climate back within the next few, say, centuries to millennia. And that might seem like a long time. It's outside of our personal lifetimes, but it is still a very brief period of time when you think about geological periods in Earth's history.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.